New York is facing twin real estate crises, a massive amount of empty office space, and almost no new housing construction. The pandemic-induced shift to remote work caught many in the commercial real estate industry off guard. But some developers and architects have been using the opportunity to lean into a business model they've been pursuing long before COVID-19, turning empty office buildings into housing. Despite their potential, office conversions face challenges due to design, regulations, and zoning laws that often limit residential use in commercial areas. Today, we're joined by Brian Steinwurzel, co-CEO and principal of GFP Real Estate, who's navigating these challenges and executing multiple office-to-residential conversions. Brian, welcome to the show. It's time to get real about conversions.
Thank you for having me.
So most agree here in the city that empty offices should be turned into housing. Why is it not that simple?
It's a great question. There's a lot of complexity to it. For us, there's three ingredients that we need to have a conversion, a successful conversion. One is that the zoning is as of right. So what that means is that without having to get any special approvals, we can file and get approved for a job to convert the building. The process to get special approvals, going through a special permit process, takes years, and capital is not that patient and willing to wait. So the second one is that we believe that there is a path to vacancy. So it's difficult to convert a building where there's many tenants that are spread throughout the building. So we either need the building to be able to be entirely vacant, or at least a large portion of it that's contiguous to be vacant. So that way we can put the risers and all the other infrastructure in to make the apartments. And then the last one is probably, the most important one is that it's economically viable. And, the hard part today is that interest rates are high, capital is expensive, and investors want to get rewarded for the risk that they're taking. And conversions are significantly more risky than doing a project out of the ground. So if we have those three ingredients, then we can have a successful conversion. If we don't, then we can't.
Let's talk through these three ingredients for successful conversions. What are some of the challenges associated with zoning?
Right. So there's a very complex zoning code that if you follow it, then you are able to get a permit without any special permission. And that is something that is not completely unique to New York, but it's unique for a big city. And it's a really positive thing for developers like us. The complication is when you do file those projects, and then it has to wind its way through this approval process. And I think one of the issues that we've had is there's a handful. One is an understaffing of some of these departments. Right? There's just literally not enough people to go through them. And then simultaneously, it seems to me that we don't give enough leeway for the people in these departments to make decisions. And so they feel like they're not able to actually sign off on applications without it rising to the highest level. And if every one of the projects has to rise to the highest level, it's just going to be a backlog until the people at the highest level can literally go through every one of the projects. Mayor Adams has created a department just for conversions to try to help this out. They won't do anything outside of the norm, but they will help to try to get, these projects reviewed. And that's all we want. We want them to be reviewed. We want them to be correct. We want them to be accurate. But we just want to get the review completed. Mm-hmm. And I think that would help significantly.
So interesting. So the second ingredient on your list is path to vacancy. Can you go into depth on what that means, what this really looks like? And I also assume that COVID has played a pretty big role in creating these opportunities with more office vacancy.
I'd say absolutely yes. So what happens with most office tenants is that since the pandemic, they've either downsized their requirement or they are in a lease where they're probably paying above market rents. Especially in older buildings, in neighborhoods like the financial district, so those tenants have an opportunity, if someone buys a building for conversion, to right-size their space and or to move to another building where they can get brand new space at potentially a much lower rent. So that opportunity for those tenants is a significant incentive to relocate. And by having that incentive, you're creating a win-win situation where the tenants are actually benefiting from that conversion, even though they're not in the building being converted.
Okay, so the last ingredient then is economic viability. What makes a project economically feasible?
Well, I think we have to start with, how do you raise money to do a project? And so you need to find investors, and those investors can invest in anything. Typically large institutional investors, which is really what we need for a lot of conversions. As you know, individual investors can do some, but really you need significant capital, and that's coming from pension funds, sovereign wealth funds, private equity funds. And those groups can really invest in anything. Typically, they have allocations towards real estate. And then within real estate, they're trying to understand risk-adjusted returns, right? So if you believe that conversions are amongst the most risky projects to undertake, the returns that those investors need to achieve to greenlight a project are significantly high. And so you need to be able to demonstrate that with the risk of potentially having to convince a tenant to move out of a building, or the construction process, all the unknowns that you might find behind the walls, probably in buildings that are older, and most of the best conversion candidates are older, not having the plans, and you know, potentially opening up a column and finding out that it's not in the exact place you thought it was going to be. All of those risks really need to generate higher returns, and so you need to be able to price the asset at a point where you're able to get through all of the issues that probably will come up when you're doing the project.
So conversions are complicated and challenging. Why are you attracted to these projects?
So when we're presenting these projects to our partners and to my family, we have a whole section about why we think we're going to be successful. You know, and it's all the things about, hey, there's an imbalance in supply and demand for housing, that that we know that New York is 200,000 or 300,000 units undersupplied, and so building into that is a positive dynamic. We know that we're going to be able to rent the space when we finish it, but then we have an entire section about all the problems that might come up, and we sit around and think about every issue that we can think of, and we try to come up with a mitigating factor. Right? How are we going to resolve this if it happens? We open up the walls and the building's just full of asbestos. Okay, well, we have a budgeted line item for that amount, and we have contingency, which is significantly higher than would be on a ground-up project. And whatever problem we can think of, we try to come up with a mitigating factor. And assuming that we've done a good enough job of pricing it and coming up with a mitigant, then we feel comfortable moving forward. And sometimes because we are pricing so many of these issues into the project, we're not going to win the bid, right? Right. And what I try to remind everyone about real estate is, if you want to buy the real estate, you have to pay more than anyone else, which is a difficult concept for some people to understand when you're in that bid process, but it's not that complicated. If you want to win, you just have to pay more.
It sounds so simple when you say it like that, but I guess it's obvious you're doing something right. GFP has a bunch of conversion projects under its belt. So once you've identified those three ingredients for success, what comes next? What sets your team apart?
You know, we have a very dynamic team, and we're agnostic to use, actually. So a lot of the projects that we've been working on over the last decade were not residential projects. We did office buildings, we did a school, we built a dorm. We're the development manager for Lincoln Center, David Geffen Hall, all different types of uses. And one thing we try to recognize is where there's dislocation and issues, right? Because in order for us to make the returns that we need to raise capital, we have to identify areas of distress. So look, when the pandemic happened, it was pretty apparent that it was a distressful situation for real estate. We own a significant office portfolio. We could feel that in our portfolio. And so what we started to do was try to identify buildings where they had as of right zoning and that they needed to transact, where the lenders were not going to wait for the pandemic to end in order to recoup whatever money they could. And so we were fortunate to identify a handful of projects. We spent considerable time and effort, even before they were brought to market, to understand what was possible there. And then when they were brought to market, we endeavored to pay more than anyone else could by trying to figure out how to mitigate the risks. Like I said, we're not going to win every one of the projects, but we were, I think, early to lean in. And the other thing we did was we identified partners. So when we built the life science building, for example, we spent a lot of time identifying a partner that had a lot of experience in it and recent experience. We brought that partner down to New York, and it's been a great partnership with King Street. But in the residential conversion, we identified that Metroloft and Nathan Berman specifically had a lot of experience, and we made a very direct effort to bring him into the fold And that first project has done really well together. I hope we do more, but we feel like we learned enough on those projects to do them on our own, and we are now.
Right, that's great. So in commercial to residential projects specifically, what are some of the biggest challenges to converting these office buildings into places where people can live?
So every one of these buildings, they're like snowflakes, right? It's all snow, but each snowflake is different. So the first project that I just mentioned that we are doing with Nathan, that building has, you know, very, very large floor plates. So on an office rentable basis, there are 50,000 square feet. And so in that kind of a floor plate, it's difficult to have enough legal light and air for each unit. And so in order to achieve the legal light and air, we had to create two light wells in the building, right? Which is a significant amount of capital that has to go into it, significant amount of construction. And then you're also losing all of that floor area, right? And in New York City, you're allowed to reallocate that to the top of the building, right? So we ended up building 10 stories on top of that building. And so that adds even more complexity. And then some other elements is when you change the surface area of a building in New York City by more than 5%, you increase it by more than 5%, then you have to bring the entire structure up to code, modern code. And that requires then a significant amount of additional steel and bracing and other issues that come around to it. So, you know, that building, large plate, you know, trying to utilize all of the floor area, you know, adds to all this extra complexity. And, you know, you have to be flexible, dynamic, and then have a team that has the ability to actually perform these kinds of complex projects. So, you know, smaller projects, smaller floor plates are easier because there's not as much gymnastics that you have to do. But then again, because it's easier, there's probably more competition for it. And they're going to, the landowner or the building owner might be able to achieve a higher price, right? So your risk-adjusted returns, depending on how much risk you think there is in the construction, might actually be lower for an easier project,
right?
Should be lower for an easier project than a larger one. So we actually sort of lean into more difficult ones, and we try to, again, mitigate all the risks that are associated, and hopefully our risk-adjusted returns outperform.
Seems like it's working out pretty well for you so far. So how can we help more office buildings convert to residential use?
I think there's a number of things we can do. So number one, getting City of Yes passed. Right. So this is an enormous effort that the city's undertaken, really a citywide effort. Every community board, every representative has been involved. You know, the city council is supposed to vote in December on it. And then hopefully it passes and the mayor signs it. And I think that will go a long way to, you know, streamlining regulation that really is outdated and it doesn't make sense. And it's not just for conversions. It's for so many different things. And so, look, a successful city should be reviewing its housing code and its just general code regularly. And I think this is an appropriate time and appropriate way to do it. The other thing is the state passed and the city has endorsed this economic incentive, right? And that's the 467M program. And that program is designed to create affordable housing. But I think it also is a big incentive to do these conversions. And that legislation is less than 6 months old. I think that as people understand it, there will be more and more groups that look at this economic incentive and say, okay, this is worth doing, and that will then push forward more conversions. You know, it does take time for everyone to understand all of these effects and to digest them and then to make a decision to move forward. And then they can start evaluating these assets and then, you know, potentially transacting. I mean, the other thing is that office buildings tend to have longer leases, and they tend to have longer loans, right? And usually you sort of need the leases to be coming to an end for some sort of vacancy or stressful moment. Like very few will take a fully occupied building that's performing very well and convert it, right? So we're really waiting for moments when buildings are going to be empty or can be empty, or there's some distress moment where the lender or the owner has to make a decision about reinvesting in the office asset, or going forward with a conversion, or selling to someone who will do a conversion. And you take all these like legislative things, these incentives, the market understanding it, them seeing people or groups like us do it and be successful, I think it'll lead to a lot more projects. It just takes time for that to occur. And, you know, we should talk about affordable for a minute. I think almost every New Yorker and probably most people in the country believe that we need affordable housing, more affordable housing. And you know, the complication around affordable housing is just like it costs $700,000 or $800,000 to build a housing unit, it still costs that same amount to build an affordable unit, and especially, which most of us agree, that the affordable unit should look a lot like, if not exactly like, a market rate unit. So if we hold those things to be true, which we do, then we need to come up with a way to pay for it, right? And if you're saying to the developer they have to pay for it, then their project just has to be so much more successful on the market rate ones. And that is very difficult to do. It's almost impossible. And that's why we don't really see a lot of housing being created in the mandatory inclusionary housing zones, right? So that legislation, while well-intentioned, isn't actually producing housing, okay? So the incentive programs like 467M, I think, will create housing because it is lucrative enough for the developer to actually embark on that project. And it's really a binary decision the developer's making. They're either going to embark on the project or they're not, right? And so if the incentive is good enough to embark on, every developer probably will embark on it. If it's not good enough, then no developer will, right? And so what's important as citizens and as legislators is that we remember that we shouldn't be afraid of success. Like if the project is successful, a lot of housing will be created and a lot of incentive will be given to do it, right? And that's difficult, especially when you look back on projects and say, well, why did we give so much incentive? Well, we give so much incentive because if we didn't, none of the housing would get created. And you know, I think what we'll see in the 485 program is that there won't be as much housing created because it's actually not lucrative. And I do not think people will opt into it. So then you have basically a failed program, one which it wasn't good enough to tip the needle, you know, tip the scale over the edge, and therefore no one really does it. You know, and I should say in 485, I think smaller buildings will be created, but those smaller buildings aren't going to be enough to solve the housing shortage that we have.
Yeah, let's talk about the housing shortage here in New York. Do you think that office to residential conversions can help at all in closing that gap?
I think right now the estimates are somewhere between 200,000 and 300,000 housing units in New York City is short. And, you know, in order to create a housing unit in New York City, it costs roughly, you know, $700,000 or $800,000. So it's very expensive. The conversions, you know, can take unutilized space and now create these housing units, which is great. But conversions are really, you know, I think in the mayor's last estimate, you know, potentially 20,000 units. Right, so it's really a drop in the bucket. It's important to do, and I think that it's like low hanging fruit, if you will. But it's really not something that we think will disrupt the supply demand, you know, the imbalance. And then, you know, my personal hope is that the city continues to reevaluate where we can create more housing density, and that those areas are rezoned. And what we've seen is in neighborhoods where there has been a significant rezoning, those neighborhoods have not only gotten a significant amount of housing, but it's really made the entire neighborhood more successful.
Yeah, Lower Manhattan is a popular example of this. But talk more about it. What's the impact of conversions on neighborhoods, especially neighborhoods that have been predominantly office districts?
I think some of the most successful office districts are those where there's a significant amount of housing. Like if you think about the Flatiron District or Union Square, you know, those are areas where people want to live and work, and it's very successful. I mean, some of the highest rents in the city, both residential and commercial. And I know that we don't all want high rent. That's not something that probably anyone wants, but it just shows you where the demand is, right? And so if there's a lot of demand, it means there's something being done there that's successful that people want. And similarly, what we've seen in Long Island City and in the rezoning and all the new buildings that have been built there is that those buildings are full, right? Which shows that there's also demand for that product. And the neighborhoods themselves have just gotten even better. Even with transportation and the opportunity to actually improve, let's say, the L train or the G train, which is undergoing an improvement now, you know, those improvements come because tax revenue rises. Tax revenue rises because there's more people or more businesses in those neighborhoods. So continuing to reevaluate these neighborhoods, even if you look at, like, let's say, Williamsburg, which was really, you know, industrial, one-story, you know, sparse housing, now it's a very robust neighborhood. And that housing creation is pushed into Brooklyn. And Brooklyn is still one of the most popular places probably in the country to live. So I think you can create housing and, you know, it'd be a positive effect for the neighborhood.
So looking ahead, do you have any hopes for the future of conversions here in New York City?
I think as a citizen, I hope that there are a lot of them, that a lot of the office stock comes offline and that the supply demand imbalance for office comes more into parity. Right now, if you own a B plus or B or lower building, you're probably having a very, very difficult time making any economic sense of leasing space to a tenant. And, so as an office owner, I certainly hope that supply demand comes into more parity. And then, simultaneously, I think that, as others see that they can be successful, that these programs all work, that the code has been simplified, that there will be a lot more in the housing imbalance will come more into balance. As a developer, like I said earlier, we're looking for, opportunities where there's a lot of distress, and truthfully, even though as a citizen, I would vote for it, as a developer, I'm hoping we find some more opportunities before it really comes into parity.
Well, Brian, thanks so much for taking the time to be here. Thanks for being real.
Thank you for having me.
Real Talk NYC is produced by the Real Estate Board of New York. Today's episode was edited and hosted by Grace Boak with help from Jason Ryan. Thanks for listening.